Nike Hercules. Stripey XM33. 4. Johnston Island was the center of launch and experimental activity for the 1962 high-altitude weapon effects testing termed Operation Fishbowl. But Johnston Island was only the core of fishbowl activity. Radiating out in all directions from this tiny island, 800 miles southwest of Hawaii, were instrumented stations, 266 of them, at sea, in the air, and on land, encompassing a major portion of the Pacific Ocean, all geared to collect effects data from nuclear bursts at high altitudes. Now to set this broad stage in greater detail. Within the limited confines of Johnston Island itself, the operations testing and support facilities were crowded into every spare niche, including space between the existing Air Force Station plant and buildings, with some apparatus and offices crammed into World War II bomb shelters, including the scientific readiness team, task force control personnel, and launch control units. At the northwestern end of the island was the Thor launch complex, joined later by Nike Hercules and Stripey units, plus a second Thor pad. Fishbowl's line of more than 30 instrument rocket launchers with attendant checkout facilities were sandwiched between the island's runway and the shore. This Pacific missile range ship, berthed at the island's lone pier, kept an electronic eye on the missile for range safety purposes. A beacon tracking system followed the scientific pods and rocket instrumentation and backed up the Pacific missile range tracking and impact prediction systems. Standing offshore were 9 instrumented test ships, vital links in the fishbowl effort, including the DAMP ship, acronym for Downrange Anti-Missile Measurements Program Ship, American Mariner. Pod recovery and surveillance ships and an evacuation aircraft carrier, which took aboard personnel non-essential to the island operation during each event, completed the ship array in the Northern Hemisphere. On islands south of the equator, in Johnston's southern magnetic conjugate area, a variety of instrumentation to collect effects data was set up for fishbowl. Stations dotted the American Samoa island of Tutuila, as well as the main islands of the Fiji and Tonga groups, and to the east, Rarotonga. After preparations in Samoa's harbor, Pango Pango, the instrumented motor ship Acania moved out prior to shot day to be on the station designated for each event, concurrent with the departure of the balloon launch vessel, Haifufu. Fiji's jet airport at Nandi was the operating base for 3 fishbowl aircraft. On each event, a KC-135 and 2 RC-121s gathered southern conjugate effects data. Closer to the equator, the coral atolls of Canton, Kwajalein, and Palmyra also held many of the trailers, structures, and antenna towers representative of the fishbowl test effort. North of Johnston, 4 main Hawaiian islands, as well as French frigate shoals, Midway, and Wake Island, mark the location for many instrumentation sites. For each event, approximately a dozen test aircraft, including optical and Iburn experiment planes, rose from Oahu's Hickam Air Force Base and headed south. Also to the west on Okinawa, in the far north at Adak and Fairbanks, as well as at Palo Alto, California, instrumentation was operated for fishbowl's test events. During the latter part of the operation, other stations were added. All in all, Of the 266 fishbowl instrument stations, 156 were on land, while 10 ships housed 80 separate project stations. 15 test aircraft carried the other 30 stations. The need for the test work carried on at Johnston and its far-flung array was compelling, for it stemmed from urgent Department of Defense operational needs requiring that high-altitude phenomena resulting from a nuclear burst be defined with simultaneous direct measurements on military operational equipment. For while America had been making rapid strides in other aspects of missile technology, its investigation of high-altitude nuclear detonation effects had lagged due to the 1958 test moratorium imposed shortly after the nation's first look at nuclear effects at high altitudes. This initial exploration in 1958 was limited to 6 shots, with attempts to collect data with untried experimental instrumentation in an environment alien to the nuclear testers. From a ship in the South Atlantic, 3 small detonations, known as the Argus series, were launched and triggered aloft for the purpose of examining the Christofilus theory that a long-lived belt of trapped electrons could be artificially created by a very high-altitude nuclear explosion. Other effects on Argus, although measured, were not thoroughly documented. In the Pacific, as part of the Hardtack series, 3 effect shots, Yucca, Orange, and Teak, were detonated at respectively 26, 43, 77 kilometers, primarily to provide information on the change of blast, nuclear, and thermal effects with increasing altitude. From Hardtack's limited test experimentation, one lesson learned was that widely diverse quantitative effects were produced at different altitudes, including major electromagnetic disturbances, causing communications and radar blackout problems. The nature of each effect could be learned only by actual testing. More than the information they furnished, these 1958 shots indicated how much more there was to learn about nuclear burst-created atmospheric ionization. Filling this information gap after the 3.5-year lull was Operation Fishbowl's mission, carefully patterned to the Department of Defense's needs. These operational requirements shaped up into objectives centering around 3 main lines of inquiry. One objective concerned ICBM acquisition, tracking, and intercept problems. It was essential for both defensive and offensive planning that experimental data be obtained on the effects of high-altitude nuclear bursts on radar performance. Another objective dealt with the evaluation of AICBM damage and kill mechanisms. DOD needed an evaluation of the effectiveness of nuclear detonations at high altitude for killing incoming ICBMs, vital to the nation's anti-ICBM effort. This knowledge, in turn, would indicate the relative vulnerability of U.S. ICBM reentry vehicles. A third objective concerned communications blackout, that is, the loss of signals due to disturbances in the ionosphere caused by high-altitude detonations. It was necessary to know the ensuing effects on military command and control systems, which require long-range communications. These military objectives meshed into the overall fishbowl objective of gaining a vertical scale of information for various altitudes and yields. Included in the wide assortment of fishbowl projects were thermal studies on I-burn, investigation of debris distribution, and documentation of the nature and transport of the magnetic field disturbance generated by high-altitude detonations. On Operation Fishbowl, nuclear detonations rent the sky 5 times over the Johnston Island area, each time during the hours of darkness. Of the 5 fishbowl shots, the highest burst was the 400-kilometer Starfish event, launched by a pod-carrying Thor missile. Its yield was 1.4 megatons. In addition to the local phenomena, the transport of bomb debris and other charged particles in the magnetic field produced colorful aurora arcing into the northern and southern conjugate regions. checkmate, like starfish, did not display a well-defined fireball. Checkmate exhibited a moderate aurora seen in both the northern and southern conjugate areas. Kingfish's fireball was well defined and its aurora moderate. From these five events, we will offer a selection of the test instrumentation associated with the DoD scientific objectives, along with some of the preliminary results obtained. Any conclusions which follow must be tempered by the understanding that the measurements made are valid only under the conditions of the experiments. For the first objective, the rockets fired from these launchers along the Johnston runway played a major role in probing the capability of detecting and tracking incoming ICBMs. Some rockets, launched in conjunction with the burst, were positioned in time and space to chart radar transmission paths through the burst environment. The aim was to help establish the space-time parameters of various blackout phenomena involving fireball, X-rays, beta, gamma, and neutrons, as well as directly measure radar capability to track and locate objects such as reentry vehicles and decoys. Guidance of anti-ICBMs through the blackout was also studied. This radar dish on Johnston Island scanned the sky to gain information on intensity and extent of the clutter produced. It mapped three frequencies of operational importance: 400, 800, and 1200 megacycles. RC-121 aircraft also measured the amount of clutter in both the north and south conjugate regions. On Johnston Island, passive radio frequency receiving instrumentation sought data on the effect of noise from the burst region on radar performance. All this instrumentation took the measure of attenuation, refraction, clutter, and noise, the chief electromagnetic effects on radar performance. A serious electromagnetic effect was attenuation in the vicinity of the fireball, both its duration and its spatial extent, neither of which was measured sufficiently on Operation Hardtack. Rocket-borne beacons launched at H plus 5 and 15 minutes to seek late-time attenuation effects obtained no readily identifiable results. On Kingfish, the damp ship observed radar transmission paths through the fireball region from a C-band beacon from H plus 5 to 25 seconds, observing complete blackout and loss of track during this period. A Johnston Island receiver observed severe attenuation at 950 and 4750 megacycles through the beta patch for 60 seconds. On tightrope, severe attenuations were measured up to 1 minute after burst. While the attenuating volume was greatly reduced in size, the amount and duration of attenuation was still significant. Refraction effects from a nuclear burst are of concern in the high-precision target tracking of ICBMs in the terminal phase. Although radar on the damp ship and Johnston Island showed no gross refractive effects from any of the bursts, preliminary results indicate a refractive jitter problem under certain conditions, involving a rapid fluctuation in the apparent angle of arrival of returning radar pulses. It was present on all events, but most pronounced on bluegill and kingfish. Another electromagnetic effect important to DoD's search capability is clutter, which could hamper radar performance for a period longer than other effects. Radar clutter is caused by ionized air, ionized bomb debris, and electrons trapped in the magnetic field. All these materials reflect radar energy, giving rise to false targets on the radar scope. Our first consideration is the reflection clutter from the fireball itself. Confined to the visible fireball, it is most pronounced when a well-formed fireball is generated. Another problem is presented by field-aligned clutter, observed in that region of the sky for which the observer is at right angles to the magnetic field lines at E-layer heights, and within an azimuth of about 15 degrees to either side of magnetic north. Field-aligned debris provides a host of fluctuating pseudo-targets over a large sky area. A radar system can evaluate them as false targets, but by sheer numbers, they may grossly overload the associated computer, which must check out each one of them. Of the serious electromagnetic effects from the burst, least bothersome to radar performance is noise. Highly sensitive advanced radar systems are adversely affected by the detonation's broadband radio frequency noise, since it reduces the signal-to-noise ratio. These instrumented pods, utilized during the starfish, bluegill, and kingfish events, played an important role in the DoD objective embracing the study of ICBM kill mechanisms, as well as determining the vulnerability of U.S. ICBM materials to these effects. The pods, three on each Thor, were engineered to be deployed to pre-calculated positions from the burst, so oriented as to expose the instrumentation to the burst. All the pods housed similar instrumentation to gain data close to the detonation on blast, neutron, and gamma radiation. However, the instrumentation that recorded X-ray and thermal effects was somewhat different. The three pods on bluegill housed instrumentation to gain data on the thermal output and its effects. The starfish and kingfish pods concentrated on X-ray radiation and its effect on re-entry vehicle materials. Some thermal measuring devices were also carried on kingfish. Post-shot recovery of the pods involved ship and helicopter convergence in the area, drawn by radio signals, flashing lights, and green dye. Fished out, the pods were taken to the Johnston Island recovery area, where removal of the scientific instrumentation for inspection and preliminary data readout was conducted. The pod program was relatively successful despite orientation problems and loss of some instrumentation due to hard landings. Preliminary results are limited mostly to the observable effects on the numerous reentry vehicle materials exposed. One other observable effect was the shadow cast as the X-rays swept past the raised instrumentation on the pod backplate. Specific quantitative values are not available yet from either the X-ray or thermal studies. However, X-ray impulses measured were near those expected. Meanwhile, the interpretative work toward application to the kill mechanisms and kill distances for various types of RVs is underway. For the DoD communications blackout objective, this station in the Fiji Islands was one of the many links in the group of simulated high-frequency networks set up for Fishbowl. Their function was to investigate the effects of high-altitude nuclear detonation on military command and control systems utilizing long-range communications. One project utilized oblique incidence ionospheric sounders in a controlled network to obtain data over 28 propagation paths covering both the primary and conjugate areas. Information was obtained on 160 frequencies in the range between 4 and 64 megacycles. Also for each event, existing military operational communications links throughout the Pacific area were monitored to determine the disruptive effects caused by the fishbowl bursts. In the high-frequency experiments, burst-induced ionization altered propagation conditions, but caused no widespread outage. After the detonation, usable frequencies tended to be higher than pre-burst values. On some paths, propagation conditions were enhanced by the creation of new modes or paths. Almost all conditions had returned to normal by H plus 2 hours, except on starfish, where effects were detectable Pacific-wide for 2 days. Checkmate caused some adverse effects on transmission paths within 700 kilometers of Johnston Island for about 30 minutes. Kingfish altered propagation conditions on paths within 2,500 kilometers of the burst point, as well as throughout the southern conjugate area for several hours. Bluegill caused blackout for about 1 minute of certain high-frequency signals whose paths passed within 200 kilometers of the Johnston Island area, with lesser effects observed on these paths for 2 hours. Tightrope produced no observable propagation changes. VHF and UHF communication circuits were not degraded by the high-altitude events. Encouraging results were obtained from a Strategic Air Command experiment, testing its airborne communication system during several high-altitude nuclear bursts. Signals from an UHF transmitter on Johnston Island were received by a KC-135 aircraft in the area and retransmitted to a relay B-47, which in turn retransmitted the signal to Hickam Air Force Base. Communications were not disrupted on this circuit by the high-altitude events. Also, the fishbowl tests were all conducted at night. Therefore, the effects are not necessarily indicative of those produced by a daytime shot. Of the many other projects of vital military interest on fishbowl, we shall give the results only on the Iburn studies. Rabbits and monkeys on airborne platforms and ground stations were exposed to the thermal radiation from both high altitude and atmospheric detonations. Chorioretinal burn results from the atmospheric shots, all detonated below 15,000 feet, confirmed previous data on the distance parameters for known yields. For contrary to expectation, bluegill produced extensive eye burning, the most severe of the series. No other fishbowl event produced burns except tightrope, where the moderate burns received conformed to predictions. We will summarize the results of Operation Fishbowl and their relationship to the DOD objectives. For answers on the anti-ICBM radar performance of acquisition, tracking, and intercept after a nuclear burst, the salient electromagnetic effects of attenuation, refraction, clutter, and noise showed the following results. The optical measurements documented the spatial, temporal, and spectral characteristics of UV optical infrared effects associated with the detonations in the burst area, as well as the southern conjugate region. In the POD program, concerned with the evaluation of AICBM damage and kill mechanisms, the pertinent finding to date is that X-ray impulses measured tend to confirm predictions. From the extensive measurements on communications blackout, some tentative conclusions can be drawn. VLF is relatively unaffected. However, rapid and persistent phase changes can be detrimental to navigational systems. LF is generally degraded, especially phase lock systems such as Loran C. HF is extensively degraded, but can be improved by the use of a system for rapid frequency shifting. VHF effects are similar to HF, except for less severe absorption. The UHF line of sight is relatively unaffected. Utilization of all these results must reflect the limitations of the fishbowl experiment. The fact that all were night bursts and that the effects were only based on single detonations. The communications problem resulting from multiple nuclear bursts would be serious, but adequate planning and technical sophistication should make it possible to maintain limited communications at all times. Besides the results on main fishbowl objectives, a host of valuable contributions were made by the many other participating projects. Since the list of findings from the five fishbowl events is a long and continuing one, with miles of records still to be reduced and analyzed, this report marks only a beginning in the Fishbowl Chronicle. With America now of necessity peering skyward in its quest for security, the results gleaned from 1962's high-altitude operation contribute both to this safeguard role and to scientific enlightenment on the effects of the atom above the atmosphere.
I saw this in the World Economic Forum, and I had to talk about it because it's such a clear indicator of the drastic shift in society, not that we're facing in the future and generally down the road, but that is actually happening right now. It's actually taking place. And if you like your doctor and want to keep him, you're going to love this. So this was on WEFForum.org. That's the Davos site, the Davos Elite. And it was written by Ida Aachen, a member of parliament in Denmark. And I checked, and as far as I could find, she hasn't been to Bilderberg or anything like that. But again, she's a member of the Davos elite.
We are 7 billion people now on the planet. We're going up to 9 billion. Think about 3 billion people entering the middle class, all wanting cars, mobile phones, computers, eating meat. I mean, this is a huge pressure on the resources we have.
But she appears to be what very much what I assume would be a Bernie Sanders-style socialist. But she's also hoping that people in the near future will own nothing. That's their big answer to income inequality. They've been talking about it at these conferences for years. They've been talking about universal income, what to do when people can't work. And their answer is, people of the future will own nothing. The Davos elite, preparing for their annual confab next month, have acknowledged the growing problem of the underman who's threatened by the rising cost of living, discouraged by the lack of better paying opportunities overall, and all the other factors that go into living in the society that we've been in. And the answer of the 1% and those even fewer who could be counted among the billionaires of the planet who own more than anyone else listed in the phone book, and their answer is that we should own nothing at all. And we talked a lot about the smart city, how much that's being used for control, but this goes beyond anything. It's straight into Marxist serfdom, actually without the problem of work and without the problem of the working man's struggle. So it's neo-feudalism, but with a new twist. Here's how it goes. Here's what Ida Aachen wrote in her column for Davos. Welcome to the year 2030. Welcome to my city. Or should I say, our city. I don't own anything. I don't own a car. I don't own a house. I don't own any appliances or any clothes. I sound like I'm from a Dr. Seuss novel. It might seem odd to you, but it makes perfect sense for us in this city. Everything you considered a product has now become a service. We have access to transportation, accommodation, food, and all the things we need in our daily lives. One by one, these things became free, so it ended up not making sense for us to own much anymore.
Why do you want to own your cell phone? I mean, you want the function, you want the service, right? Why do you want to own a cell phone if you can just lease it? And if you lease, why shouldn't you lease your refrigerator or your washing machine or your dishwasher? Or why do you want to own it? I mean, it's not like the plastic in the middle. It's like, I own a broke dishwasher. I mean, wow.
People don't own cars anymore. There's driverless vehicles and flying cars for longer journeys. I think we've had that one promised before.
So why don't you want to go into a business model where the company owns it?
Ida Aachen writes that in 2030, in our city, we don't pay any rent because someone else is using our free space whenever we don't need it. Someone else is sleeping in your living room when you're not around, or cooking in your kitchen when you're done making dinner. She writes, my living room is being used for business meetings when I'm not there, and once in a while, I will choose to cook for myself. It's easy. Even the necessary kitchen equipment isn't owned. It's delivered to the door by drones within minutes. Environmental problems seem so far away, she says, because of course, it can never really be that far away from Agenda 21. She writes, the air is clean, the water's clean, and nobody would dare touch the protected areas of nature because they constitute such value to our well-being. No one is allowed to go into the wilderness, but in the cities, there's plenty of green space and plants and trees all over. She says that even shopping has changed. You don't really shop anymore. It's more of a choosing of things just to use and to borrow. And that she used to find it fun to actually pick things out for herself, but over time, she found the algorithm did it for her better and knows her own taste better than she does. And there's a flashback, of course, when AI and robots took over so much of our work.
And his name is Mr. Machine.
We suddenly had time to eat, to sleep well, to spend time with people. And instead of working, there was thinking time, creative time, and development time. But for a time, everything was just entertainment. She laments those who lost their way, who decided it was too much, all this technology. Those who felt obsolete and useless when robots and AI took over. It sounds like Davos watched our film, which, by the way, you can watch on Amazon Prime, and now they're writing about it, and now it's really happening in the world that we live in. They say that people who got upset with the political system moved out, and they live in basically 19th century villages with old technology, and basically they're not valued in society, but neither is anyone else. So that's the future society, but you don't own anything, and...
Do you know how much a car drives, how much of its life? 4%. Or if you take a drill, it's used 15 minutes. It's not a lot, is it? And most of us, I know there are some guys here that really love to own a drill. But for the rest of us, we just want a hole in a wall, right? And I think we're going to a place where we just want mobility, where we don't care so much about owning a car. It's actually a bit of trouble. If you just come to driverless car and pick me up and I can drive around, and this car will be driving all the time.
Things could be taken away at a whim, but even this parliament member from Davos writes about the pitfalls. Once in a while, she writes, I get annoyed about the fact that I have no real privacy. Nowhere can I go and not be registered. I know that. I know somewhere everything I do, think, and dream of is recorded. I hope that no one will use it against me. But she still insists that this is a way better society because in the old society, terrible things were happening. There were lifestyle diseases from couch potatoes, and there was pollution and waste and climate change and congested cities and social unrest and unemployment and everything else that's part of life. So she says that's why the world of 2030 would be so much better if we own nothing, and we were basically peons who don't even have to do work and really just have to hang out. Well, it sounds really cool for a feature-length film or a theme park ride. And you're all like, yeah, wow, cool, man, I want my turn, that sounds pretty good. But after you go around the block once or twice, you think, I've seen this movie, it's 2001.
I'm sorry, Dave, I'm afraid I can't do that.
It's Logan's Run, The Wizard of Oz, it's Rollerball, it's The Hunger Games, Gattaca 1984, Brave New World, Divergent, Soylent Green, etc. I've seen that movie, I've actually seen all those movies. And you realize one fatal flaw. What happens if they don't like what I say? And what happens if I don't like or believe in what they do anymore? What about my rights, man? There's no guarantee of freedom or absolute respect of rights, and you're just another, basically, head of cattle in the global management system, the biodiversity system, of which you count very little in the overall schemes. And you don't even have privacy in your own head when you sleep at night. There is no guarantee of freedom or absolute respect of rights at all, including privacy, and everything shifts according to what is already acceptable and what certain people wish to make acceptable. And it's always between those lines, and your rights mean nothing because your dreams were so unlimited that you'd fall for anything. We all love our stuff, and free stuff is better, we take the ride, and grumble as quietly as possible about the drawbacks and the back-end shafting and raw deals that are constantly offered up. The theme park ride would become torture rather than entertainment if you were never allowed off of it. And basically, I think once reality kicked in, it might not be the best system. Because in this future system which they're building, they're shifting people into it, and the internet's a huge part of it, there is no guarantee of freedom. They will censor you, they will shut down your channel, they will deauthorize your account, your bank card will not work.
First of all, we all know these smart cities of the future will be highly technologically controlled grids where everything, including you, will be tracked and traced everywhere you go. Some people chuckle when you bring up Mark of the Beast, but there will be some kind of chip or digital tattoo or some kind of thing that will be required for you to move about in this city, to travel, to engage in commerce, and just think about it. Right now, we've already been upgraded to a chip system in our credit cards, where we're getting used to seeing a chip every time we pay for something. Just follow that out to its logical conclusion. Davos, Bilderberg, George Soros, United Nations, all these other elites and foundations are really pursuing universal basic income, which essentially makes the government your boss and leaves you completely dependent on it for everything. And it's no joke to say that in a society like that, if you don't follow the rules, they can turn your access off, like Sandra Bullock's life in the movie The Net. And those rules, by the way, might start out at an acceptable point that seems reasonable, but just consider all of the constraints they can put on you and yours and how you live your life in the interest of the public good in our collective city of 2030. Mandatory vaccinations, for example, and medical treatments. Your health, including mental, will be considered community property in a place like this. For two, the entire city will obviously be a gun-free zone. Or, you know, maybe they decide nobody's gonna eat red meat anymore except once a year on your birthday. You know, the United Nations came out and said that red meat's bad for you, so maybe they'll just make sure no one can even have that. You just don't even get access to it. Really, basically, just any rule they decide to make, if you're in this system and economically dependent upon it, you're giving yourself up to the whims of the collective. Maybe they outlaw homeschool. Or maybe they force everyone to get up and exercise at 8 a.m. every morning because it's good for you and because obesity is now considered a disease. And think about it, with Obamacare, they've already got everyone paying an individual shared responsibility payment if you don't buy their health insurance. There's no limit to the number of things that they will be able to control in a society where the majority of everyone owns nothing and is completely dependent on the government for everything that they do get. So how much more of a leap is it to say these kinds of things, right? Maybe they, you know, mandate some sort of antidepressant in the water, you know, for the good of society, keep everyone real happy and chilled out. Sounds loony. It sounds like Brave New World. Well, so did the suggestion of the future these people are creating right now once upon a time. But they're talking about it like this is a real possibility that they're actually working towards. If you think about it, the younger generations have been socially engineered to live in this society, to not say anything that's going to offend someone else because they might get triggered and everyone should have a safe space. These kids have been engineered not to buy houses, not to buy cars, not to get married, not to have families, and really not to be able to find their way out of a paper bag without Googling it first. They have become totally dependent on the internet and computers for the majority of their existence. Back when we were kids, for example, we couldn't wait to turn 16 and get our driver's license because that meant freedom. But larger and larger portions of millennials are still living with their parents at age 30 now. They don't even know what freedom is anymore. They don't even have the same concept of freedom or privacy. Privacy doesn't even exist for these kids. They have always lived their lives sharing everything about themselves on the computer, filming themselves all the time and being filmed all the time, and that's just normal to them. So the privacy concept is being quashed anyway. This is why Bilderberg asked a couple years back, does privacy exist? It was a rhetorical question because they know that privacy has already been extinct for a while. And these millennials have been engineered for this exact smart grid city, where everything, right down to the trash can, will have sensors in it so the proper authorities can be alerted in real time if you don't recycle properly for the good of the planet. We've already shown you guys before in reports about the smart city. Everything in your house will be connected to the internet. It will be sending out signals in real time, data about everything you're doing in your house, what you're eating, how much energy you're using, water, I mean, just pretty much everything, so that it can be tracked and monitored and they can make sure you stay within your quota. And if you turn up the air conditioning a little too high in the summer, they'll make sure and turn it down for you. You'll really have no control over your life at all. You will be part of this collective system. And the society these people are pushing us towards is a dystopic nightmare that's already happening in slow motion. You won't even be able to sleep at night in your own bed, because it won't be your bed, and have privacy in your own brain. So I guess count me as one of those poor saps that became obsolete and is living out in the wild like a crazy person in a tree or whatever. That's fine. Like hell I'm gonna live in this crazy ass society that they're suggesting. I can't even fathom it. It sounds insane.
Car share for a long time was a problem because people left stuff in the cars and it's a little bit disgusting. But now, you know, you rape people, so you don't leave stuff in the car, you just behave better. So the information technology has made it much more easy to share things.
And again, we talked about all this stuff, all these themes come up in our film Obsolete, which we're just trying to talk about this stuff. The end of the need to work for a living and the institution of the universal basic income concept, it sounds good and it makes sense in many regards, it sounds like a better system, but it is fundamentally flawed and therefore doomed. Can somebody pass me a roll of toilet paper and help me order some kitchen materials? Maybe a breakfast bowl.
Do you own your own underwear?
You don't even own your own clothes.
Number one, to come into the truth movement, if you're really concerned about truth, you've got to check an ego at the door, okay? You do not know everything. A lot of you think you do, but you don't. I certainly don't. Through your school system, through your education that you're so proud of, that builds your whole ego, your whole value in life, it's impossible for you to discard it and admit you were deceived. Let me tell you something. You've been deceived. It's not your fault. You can let go of your ego. Nobody's going to laugh at you, except other people that can't let go of their ego. But people that have caught on to the con and realized the power grab that's taken place, they're not going to laugh at you. They're going to welcome you. I'm telling you again, the worst thing they fear is the hive mind. The one thing they fear is 300 million people in the United States coming together to on one topic and saying, this makes no sense. We need answers. Why is the flat earth so important? Because it shows the deception. There are enough reasonable questions to create reasonable suspicion that we've been lied to. They can't afford to keep being asked. Whether the Earth actually turned out to be diamond-shaped, cross-shaped, pear-shaped, there's enough to see that it's not what we've been told. And once that is revealed, everything these governments have done becomes illegitimate. That is why it matters. And that is why they will do anything they can to keep us fighting, keep us distracted, keep us at odds against each other, just like the entire world. Whether it be Christians against Muslims, blacks against whites, government that truly has your best interest, your freedom at heart, or does it sound like a government that wants to keep you constantly busy on paying attention to anything but what they're doing? And this truth movement is no different. Because as soon as the topic starts going where everybody could actually make a stand and say, hey, wait a minute, this needs to be answered. This is a big one. And I don't care what anybody says, the flat earth, the shape of the earth, is the biggest conspiracy and has been used to manipulate, deceive, and control us all. If God forbid everybody came and started demanding answers, and once they can't provide those answers, people realize they are busted. It can't be a mistake. It can't be anything but the deception and control mechanism it is. Flat Earth is not a psyop. Flat Earth destroys the psyop, every psyop that's been used to control us for as long as they've known about it. So this system has been in power and control for hundreds of years, ever since they convinced the rest of the world that they didn't know where they live, and created this fantastical scenario to make people feel insignificant and to follow those that appear to know better, that are just better liars, deceivers, that have no conscience, and will do everything and anything to everybody and anybody they can to keep that power. Because people are waking up. And no matter how much they try to suppress this flat earth movement, oh, it's gonna keep moving one way or another. You can see it. People are waking up. So now, louder than ever, I can hear that clock. Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. It's a religion. It's all a religion. You know why? Because government is a religion. Government is the majority of the world's true God, because they believe that these people have some sort of power, that, and they've even convinced us that we've given it to them. They still have us convinced in 2015, the age of instant communication, that we for some reason need representatives in a city that's not even part of this country called Washington, D.C. to represent us. That in this age of instant communication, we can't represent ourselves for some reason. That's how deep the brainwashing and the indoctrination has gone. They still have you convinced that this government should be run on the same system it was run when people were back on horseback using telegraphs and Pony Express. That's why they had these representatives, had to go to Washington, so that they could go back home to this group of a few hundred thousand people and say, well, what do you guys want? Okay, I'll go tell them. And they travel for a week to Washington, D.C., or however long it takes. That's why you needed representatives. Now I can push this button and talk to anybody in the world. What the fuck do I need a representative for? Because it's the power system, the control system. They have to keep indoctrinating you in schools, teaching you about everything and anything but where you live. Now they have to treat out all the money that was going into the educational system to control your mind isn't working anymore. People see how stupid everybody is. That is the failure of government. See, flat earth proves the failure of government, period. Because it's either deceived and lied and indoctrinated us all into a false system, or it's completely failed in making people realize if they really live on a globe, a lot of people don't see it. So your education system has failed now, hasn't it? In order to believe it, we've got to believe a bunch of math formulas that only a few people in the world can supposedly understand, and we've just got to take your word for it. Here in this age of all this technology where I can get on this phone, record this video, and send it out to the world, they can't seem to find a way to easily, simply prove to everybody on the planet where they live. It always depends on some formulas that the majority of the people don't understand. And again, the people that do understand it don't understand it. They either that know it's bullshit, or they believe it's bullshit because it's just religion and it's not proven. It's just twisted formulas to fit their agenda. It doesn't wash out in reality. What difference does it make? What difference does it make? Yeah, that's their favorite line. Got a lot of people, what difference does it make? You can't figure out what difference it makes? If you can't figure out what difference it makes that the people running your world have fucking lied to you over and over your whole life, if you can't figure out that someone lying to you is trying to control you. Suppressing of information, of knowledge, is control. Deception of information and knowledge is a form of control. So what difference does it make? It makes a big difference, because once they start omitting information or lying about information about where you live, they're doing it to control you, period. Why am I having to explain this to critical thinkers in the truth movement? Where you live, it's been a lie the whole time, and if everybody would just come together and demand answers, they would be in checkmate. They would not know what the fuck to do. They cannot prove it. They can't prove the globe because it doesn't exist. So once you call on them, they're done. You then remove them from power and go from there. That rips down all the other conspiracies. You then have access to all these top secret government files that national security, that they hide all the evidence under. The way you control billions of people is to keep them divided and fighting each other. So they focus on anything and everything but you and how you're controlling them all.
Hey guys, so I've been looking over the last few days for some more photos of various things around the world. I've actually been looking more at caves these last few days, and my mind again is just completely blown with what is out there, and as a collective we just don't know about it. It's just insane. Now just look at this photo here and just tell me what you think, just tell me what you see, like just give me a comment below, because when I saw this I was like, this is like looking inside of something alive. Like, this is the inside of a person or a being. Like, how bloody and meaty and veiny is this picture? Now, this is a cave somewhere. Someone's posted it on a cave insight, and for the life of me, I cannot find the location of this. So if you've seen this before or you know where this is, please do let me know. Because this is just incredible, and I want to look at the whole cave of this thing, because it's just, look at it, look how bloody and meaty this is, and then just look at here, like look at the vein network going on here. Now this is a cave, this is stone, but look at it, this is like one of the most meatiest things I've seen yet, and this is a cave. It just absolutely blows my mind what is out there. It's just incredible. Absolutely amazing. And then you'll have seen this floating around on the mud fossil sites the last couple of days. But that's made it a bit blurry, actually. But yeah, this is all these are houses on a giant. They've actually been building on the remains of a giant. It's just absolutely incredible. It's just... And yet I wonder if these people, they must surely know the shape of what they're living on. Do they ever question why it's that shape? Surely you must know. Like, because these aren't very big houses. This is like a town, or it's not like a country. You know, this is easier to see. But it just blows my mind. It's just, what is out there is just, it's insane. Now again, these are some of those hexagonal columns, these incredible sarcastic volcanoes make. Not. But just look how bloody these ones look. They look really, really bloody. So again, when I was looking for caves, I came across this one. Look at the size of this thing. I know this isn't a cave, this is more like an arch. But absolutely immense. Absolutely beautiful and immense. Now, things only of enormous size, could make things like this. You know, these are something that the Titans created. You know, this is the remains of Titans. And the more I look into things, and the more that is being brought to my attention as well, the elites 100% know exactly what we are living on. The amount of subliminal messages they put in our faces from all around the world. You know, people have sent me pictures from sleeping giants in the Bank of America, like there's a giant in the hill. Another airport, there's giants coming out of the ground. Every single bloody film is, you know, so many films are based on giants, titans, stone giants, things coming to life from the ground creating life. Like, these elites know absolutely what is going on. And the only reason we don't know what is going on is because we've fallen into the distraction game. And I made a video on that the other day, like, the constant distraction. And it is so true. We are so tied up in the material world that we have no interest in the natural world. We're just so consumed and distracted by materialism and being a consumer, that we're missing out what is right under our noses. We are missing out on finding out about our true history. So again, this is, I think you pronounce this Kauai, I think it is. It's in Hawaii. But look at this, man. I think this is where they film a lot of the Jurassic Park films. Absolutely immense. And when I first saw this, I was like, I can see a dragon. But I do think I could be wrong, because the whole island on this one side looks like this. But in this picture, it looks like a head, and then the body, and then this looks like a big, you know, foot, paw. I could be right, I could be wrong. Again, we need to really scope the whole island. And when you look at Google Maps on this, there's actually a few islands dotted about. But it looks like they were all possibly one thing that's broken up. But, you know, go and have a look, guys. Go see what you think, because it's immense. I've got some more pictures of that here. So again, this is the same part of the island. Just look how amazing this is. Look how straight and up and sharp these are. Absolutely incredible. I'd absolutely love to go here. That looks like a waterfall. But if this was a dragon, if it was, look at the size of this thing. Like, see that little dot there? That would be us. You wouldn't even, this dragon probably wouldn't even see you, man. You'd be just completely invisible. We'd be like bacteria in size. But again, the same island. Just look at this. And again, just look at all the red. You know, this coppery, bronzy, coppery that I really believe is dried blood. And you'll see it's all kind of at the bottom. There ain't much at the top. And I think that's because when something dies, the blood sort of stops and settles at the bottom rather than obviously be at the top. But again, this is the same island. Just look how meaty and bloody this looks. It's just absolutely incredible. No, this is just immense. Whatever this was immense. It was huge. I am more inclined to say dragon of some form, because it just doesn't look like anything we've seen today. So again, I went here the other day. This is Brimham Rocks in North Yorkshire, and it's absolutely incredible. It's one of the best places I've found in England to go to for, like, natural rock formations. It is just amazing, and I've seen all these with my own eyes, so I can vouch for these are legit. Like, these are balancing on that, you know. It's amazing. So I've put this in here because we seem to have an addiction with putting huge, giant sculptures all around the world. They are everywhere. This thing is huge and it's coming up out of the ground. Okay? What inspires these people with millions and millions of pounds to create sculptures like giants coming up out of the ground? Now, what inspires these thoughts from these, you know, very wealthy elite people? You know, these people are tuned in and they put it right in front of our faces. And why, you know, why can't they just come out and say, look, you know, this is the truth? Why do they have to do it all subliminally? Can't even speak now, but why is it all subliminal? You know, why can't they just say, look, this is our true history? But still be a consumer, you know, you decide. Why does it have to be so backwards and inverted all the time? That is, again, if you've been around the Mud Fossil groups, especially Mud Fossils University, they really believe and they go into the chemistry and the biology and the autonomy of why they believe this is the insides of a giant. You know, it's incredible. It absolutely blows my mind. It's amazing what is out there. And it's right under our noses. So again, that looks like a boob. You decide, guys. So again, this is Brimham Rock. So I went the other day. Now, the area of this is just huge. It's so massive. It's incredible. So again, another earth giant coming up out of the ground. Absolutely incredible. Do you know, what is this, man? Look at this. Absolutely incredible. And look, again, I'm seeing, like, the blood that has settled, like, as it's leaning forward. But, yeah, what was that? A lot of things I really had to tell what they were, because, obviously, erosion and, you know, things do get messed up. But, again, this looks like a chin and a nose coming out of a hill. That very well could be the face of a giant or a titan. So this is at Fish Rock in America. But just look at these. It's absolutely incredible. Has anybody been there? Because I would love to go one day. The whole area of this place looks phenomenal. So again, this is Brimham Rocks. Now this is actually huge because my son and his two friends sat under here the other day and we took the picture. So this is huge and it's it really is balancing on that. And it hasn't been created, it really is like that. It's a natural formation. So again, and the whole area is just full of stuff like this. So again, this is in a cave. I think this is in China, I believe. But what would create something like that? I know they give us all this millions and millions of years of, you know, the world slowly terraforming and I've stopped buying into it. I do believe in terraforming, but I don't think it was wind and rain erosion. I believe it was titans and giants and angels and the most craziest of things we can possibly imagine. Which they're not crazy. We've only been programmed to believe that it's crazy. You know, they put it in front of our faces. They tell us from birth, we are told the stories of giants and titans, and yet you're made to believe you're crazy if you actually believe that these things existed. It's so backwards, but yeah, just look at these rock formations. Like, there's nothing else around that for a good massive distance. You know, what creates something like this? Absolutely incredible. Again, look at this. No eyes, nose, mouth, potentially, possibly. Now again, look at that. He is brave standing there, man. A slight earthquake and boom. But bloody hell, look at the size of that thing just hanging and just stuck right there. Now this isn't, you know, natural rain and wind. It's complete crap. This was something alive, 100%. So this is called Monkey Rock. I don't really think it looks like a monkey, but could be. A lot of these things literally are called after what they were. So again, more boob rock for you. So yeah, and these, you know, some, a few people have said you like to show pictures of vagina rocks. And I'll tell you why. It's because when we think of giants and titans, we only really think of the faces, and when we see pictures, we only really think of the heads, and we kind of forget that they've got a whole body going on as well. And it's, you know, so it could possibly be, if it was a world full of just heads and no body parts, then it could just be pareidolia. It could just all be in the mind. We could just all be going crazy, and, you know, we're all making it up as we go along. But we have got the rest of the body parts, like, all over the world. They are everywhere. We've got, you know, vaginas, penises, boobs, butts, feet, legs, arms, bellies. We've got everything. Blood, vein networks, brains. We've literally got everything. Anything you can think of in and out of the body, you can find that in the world. It's undeniable. What is in our realm, you know, what has created our realm? So again, it's just, if you go to Mud Fossils University, they'll tell you exactly why that is a titan's vagina. Yes, people, I do know how to say that word. But, yeah, this is, somebody commented on my channel about the Titan Cave in England, and I was blown away. This thing ain't even that far from me, so I'm going to go try and check it out soon. But Titan Cave, man, they've even called it Titan. It's just amazing. So again, just, you know, blood, it's hanging, just, it's not, it's just, oh, it blows my mind what is in our world. So again, this is Titan Cave. Now you can see a guy here, and right down there you can see another guy. This thing is huge. I think it's the biggest found in England, and this were only discovered a few years ago, the Titan Cave. It blows my mind, honestly. So again, yeah, another face here. You got your nose, mouth. People go skiing on this thing, apparently. Oh man, if only she knew. If only she knew what she were doing. And back to the beginning. So yeah, there you go, guys. Some more pictures for you all. Do you know, this world, this realm, every single day I learn something new, and it is incredible to me. We need to really start fully appreciating where we live, because the more we dig into all this, the more we're losing, and the more we're going to understand, the less we're going to understand, sorry. So I'm going to leave it there, guys. Hope you enjoyed it, and take care.
You understand politics, you think you understand political parties, you're all full of crap, you don't know what the Illuminati is, if you're Republican
or you're Democrat, you're wrong!
Why? It's this easy. It's called divide and conquer. That's why there's two parties and only two. And they're controlled by the same people at the very top who belong to the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberger Group. They also belong to the Trilateral Commission, and you people don't even know what the hell that is. But if you did know, you would know that these are the people that control your world by making global policies that you never vote on, and by which parties both serve and belong to these organizations and control your world. Now, here's how it works. Really easy. Divide and conquer can only work if the people that are divided are not aware of the falsely created division. If you're not aware of it, then it works. If you know about it, then it don't work no more. If you have socialism without capitalism, it becomes communism. If you have capitalism without socialism, it becomes fascism. And it's just that easy.
I love you.
That's all you need to know. That's why Masonic symbols are all over your freaking money. But you don't pay any attention. Ridiculous.
Today, I would like to talk about the principles and strategies of the depopulation lobby, their operating principles and strategies. And so far, I have identified 12, and I have placed them on a list in no particular order. The first one on my list is the misuse of science as a weapon. The depopulationists always use the latest technological innovations and scientific discoveries to advance the depopulation genocide one step further. To stay ahead of them, we must look at all technological innovations and scientific discoveries and figure out how they can be misused to damage our fertility and immunity. It is that simple, but it is very laborious and time-consuming, and one must also be multidisciplinary. They try to get a head start by often placing promising research under the control of the military-industrial complex and classify it as secret. This way, they can misuse scientific discoveries and technological innovations until the rest of the scientific community catches up and provides evidence of harm, which takes time. And by then, of course, the damage is done. The second strategy is our killing imperceptibly. This operating principle could also be called the smaller the better and the slower the better. Every method of depopulation they employ must be imperceptible to the five senses humans have evolved to respond to threats. It must also be slow acting, so the cause and effect chain is obscured by the passage of time. If a threat cannot be seen, heard, smelled, felt, or tasted, then human beings will not respond to it and will fail to protect themselves. And if the damage done to the human reproductive and immune systems is over long periods of time and over multiple generations, then no one will notice. The developed world, being in the third or even fourth generation of affected individuals, each generation is born increasingly damaged and has therefore no point of reference as to how they're damaged, because they never lived an undamaged life. The third operating strategy is that of plausible deniability, and I've discussed that here and there over the past few lessons. Every method of depopulation used by our genocidal governments and the UN system with the help of the military-industrial complex and the permission of religious authorities must be subject to easy manipulation through policies that have dual purposes, one public and the other classified. This allows governments and all those responsible for committing genocide to hide behind plausible deniability, so the legitimacy of the state and the rule of law can be preserved through semblance. The secret objectives of the DEPOP program are thus hidden behind duplicity and plausible deniability. In this fashion, when methods of depopulation and the damage they do are exposed, no one can prove beyond a reasonable doubt intent on the part of those responsible and correlation to the said method. And this shelters the state, which claims innocence, from legal liabilities and the loss of legitimacy. The fourth strategy might be called, let them dig their own graves. The vast majority of people involved in the global depopulation program are not aware that their labor and wits are used to this end. This is the result of this fourth operating principle of the depopulation lobby: manipulation through compartmentalization of knowledge and tasks, hierarchical organizations, and financial incentives. This allows a very small number of individuals in the inner circle of the depopulation lobby to cheat everyone into working against their own best interests and digging their own graves. Compartmentalization prevents individuals from seeing the big picture and understanding the system of engineered depopulation. Hierarchical organizations allows those at the very top to delegate those below to do what is needed to advance a depopulation genocide without questioning authority. And financial incentives create the motivation necessary to force people to abandon their consciences to survive, as well as taking advantage of those worst traits of human nature to power the genocide. This organization locks everyone into a system designed to eliminate the vast majority from the face of the earth by virtue of their own effort. The fifth operating strategy is that of using our weaknesses against us. Now, this principle of the depopulation lobby is to target first and foremost and hit hardest those who indulge in what might be called vice: sexual promiscuity, drug abuse, smoking, alcohol, gluttony, and so on. They do this because it is easier to justify attacks against those who sin or have unhealthy lifestyles, and because the depopulation program is ethically framed by religious authorities who think in terms of good and evil. They also do this because those who burn the candle at both ends are expected to die prematurely anyhow, and their death, morbidity, and sterility will not raise unwanted questions and can be blamed on their own behavior. Last but not least, they target sinners because their disappearance will not be mourned and socially and society will benefit. Incidentally, that is why the depopulation lobby encourages self-indulgent and destructive behaviors and floods society with legal and illegal drugs. To this end, the most potent depopulation toxins are hidden inside sex products, recreational drugs, tobacco, alcohol, and snacks. The sixth strategy is that of poisoning the gifts. Anything and everything governments and the UN system give for free, whether to individuals or nations, in the developing or developed world, has a hidden depopulation purpose, be it medicines, vaccines, aid, water filtration systems, insecticides, treated bed nets, social assistance, medical care, etc. This is also true of the many NGOs that work with the system and within the system and are active in the developing world especially, and equally true of NGOs that work with the system in the developed world and target the poor. This operational principle is called let them come to us rather than chase after them, and is intended to prevent resistance to depop methods and to save money. The intelligent reaction to such quote-unquote gifts is to say thanks but no thanks. If you accept such gifts, you will lose far more than you will gain. You will lose either your fertility, your health, your independence, your sovereignty and dignity, or all of the above, because every one of those so-called gifts will be laced with poison and comes with conditions as well as hidden objectives. You may even lose your life. The seventh operational strategy is that of taking the top. By seizing control of the highest authorities, be they secular or religious, the depopulation lobby is in a position of highest authority in every domain, be it medical, pharmacological, political, ethical, environmental, scientific, etc. To speak from the highest podium and dictate policy, the depopulation lobby has first created the international system and placed it above the national authorities, and then over time has infiltrated and taken over the leadership of all or most national authorities. This way, all false research and subversive policies they issue from the international level can be seconded at the national level and cannot be challenged. A perfect example is that of medicine and public health, whereby the World Health Organization, the WHO, was created and declared the highest medical authority, followed by its 6 regional offices, and last by national ministries of health, all of which are fully controlled by the depopulation lobby. To have absolute control of human health and turn medicine and public health into the handmaidens of genocide, the depopulation lobby then set out to create quote-unquote independent medical organizations, to use them to drown any opposing voice, censor all dissenting scientists and doctors, and overwhelm the public with false medical information. The 8th operational strategy is that of destroying the family. They weaken the 3 essential social bonds, individual conscience, family structure, and social safety nets, so as to create an impossible social and economic environment for families to thrive in and raise children. The individual's conscience is weakened by forcing citizens to choose between being decent or being employed. And the depopulationists do this by keeping unemployment artificially high, wages artificially low, and the fear of losing one's job constant. The latter being accomplished with high immigration rates, short unemployment insurance coverage, and competition with low-wage regions. The family structure is weakened by keeping living costs high so as to force both men and women to earn a wage to be able to sustain a family, by delaying entry into the workforce and denying young workers a living wage, by making employment contingent on unnecessary schooling and qualifications, by criminalizing previously acceptable social behaviors to destroy families through incarceration, by depriving parents of the ability to discipline children as they see fit, by long employment hours and short vacation time, by high taxes, by flooding society with drugs, both legal and illegal, by flooding television and movie theaters with programs and movies that deride family values, by elevating sex, same-sex marriages to equal status with traditional marriages, by misusing popular culture to turn men and women against one another, and by intruding into family life with laws designed to destroy families and transfer their assets to the judiciary or the state. And social safety nets are weakened by misallocating taxpayers' money towards wasteful programs and institutions to starve social programs of needed funds, by encouraging crimes of desperation and subverting the safety and cohesiveness of communities, and by allowing the free transfer of capital, technology, and production facilities to foreign countries, while at the same time allowing corporations free and unfettered markets. The combined results of all of the above is to prevent families from forming, to force their demise once they form, and to limit the number of children born to couples, which is why now a majority do not marry, a majority of marriages fall apart, and half of all couples remain childless. Strategy number 9, no one is spared. This 9th operational principle of the depopulation lobby is to subject everyone to depop methods and spare no one. Only the architects of the depop program and those belonging to the highest echelon of power protect themselves and their offspring, and they do this without the knowledge of all other individuals involved in the program and fully aware of the depopulation genocide. This principle is considered necessary to be able to morally justify subverting the reproductive and immune systems of mankind. What they do unto us, they also do unto themselves, which is why the intellectual and genetic quality of our leaders is as diminished as our own, and why we seemingly have only simpletons in power. You will note, for instance, that when religious leaders meet, they drink only from glass bottles, whereas when politicians meet, they drink from plastic bottles. The religious leaders are, of course, in charge of the depop program and protect themselves, whereas politicians, save for a select few, are clueless and poison themselves with every mouthful they drink. This is how those in control of the depopulation genocide protect themselves, for instance, from bisphenol poisoning. The same applies to all other DPOP methods, but they cannot be observed as they happen in the privacy of homes. Strategy 10, seize the wealth. This 10th operational principle of the depopulation lobby is to concentrate the world's wealth in their own hands, both at the individual level and in banking, so as to subject everyone else to their absolute power. Monetary coercion replaces military force. It is a step up from previous generations, but nevertheless, it is a coercive system. As the depopulation program advanced to every region of the world, so the concentration of wealth advanced along with it, and was facilitated by friendly policies. Wealth wielded by the inner circle of the DPOP lobby forces people and nations to abdicate ever more control, rights, and liberties to the international system, so the covert depopulation and coerced globalization matrix of control can progress to the next phase. On the level of individuals, this was necessary to destroy the middle class, transfer capital from the developed to the developing world, and halt the reverse and reverse the affluence of the developed world, so the developing world can catch up. On the national level, this was needed to transfer control over natural resources from national leaders to international or multinational corporations to make vital natural resources and the goods produced from them available across the world and thus close the gap between the developing and the developed world. Now that I have exposed the global depopulation program and governments can no longer use foreign aid to fund the depopulation genocide in the developing world, these great concentrations of personal wealth are needed more than ever, which is why the world's billionaires have pledged to give the greater bulk of their wealth to quote-unquote philanthropy. Their ideal philanthropy, of course, is sterilizing vaccines, poisonous genetically modified crops and animals, water filtration systems that render the water into a sterilizing agent, malaria therapies misused to deliver the sterilizing artemisinin into the bloodstream of every man, woman, and child in the developing world, insecticide-treated bed nets that double as contraceptives, etc. First and foremost, this great and unprecedented concentration of wealth enables the depopulation lobby to seize control over food and water, thus over the basic elements of life. The depopulationists need full control over the basic elements of life in order to poison every human being on the planet into sterility and morbidity through food and beverages, which are the inescapable necessities of life. They do this through agrochemical and agricultural biotechnology corporations that have been allowed to merge in defiance of all competition laws to the point where 90% of the world's seeds, pesticides, and herbicides are controlled by half a dozen multinational corporations that are soon to become just three. In this system, the depopulationists are the shepherds and we are the sheep. It is a system designed to deprive us all of free will and sovereignty. Strategy 11, hide DPOP behind national security. While pretending to govern transparently, the depopulation lobby uses national security to hide the crimes they commit to control population growth. More government documents are classified now than at any other time in history, both numerically and proportionally. And the vast majority of documents classified and buried under the pretext of national security are in one way or another related to the depopulation genocide. In addition to secrecy, the depopulation lobby uses other strategies to hide things in plain sight. For instance, to openly exchange information about progress of sterilization by fluoridation, the depopulation lobby publishes research that measures the level of fluoride in urine, but keeps to itself the threshold known to result in sterilization or partial sterilization. When all other methods of concealing the depopulation genocide are insufficient, such as compartmentalization of knowledge, hierarchical structures, and financial incentives.